Okay, we might get started. I think some people are still coming in. We've heard a lot of about disruption yesterday with changes in consumer behaviours and expectations and being the enabler of new types of insurance, such as the sharing economy. So I'm looking forward to hearing Scott and Dean's presentation on how we thrive in this new era. There was four authors to the presentation, Gina Cook, Scott Duncan, Dean Marcus and Amy Yu, and we've got two of them here today to present to us. Just a little bit about the speakers. Scott and Dean have a keen interest in technology, its impact on society and what this may mean for the future of the general insurance industry. Specifically, they are intrigued by the challenges and opportunities technology presents and what these changes mean for current insurance business models. Scott is a senior actuary at Taylor Fry, specialising in self-insurance and capital modelling. He enjoys swimming, loves Harry Potter, and has recently become best friends with two Staffordshire Bull Terriers named Titan and Bronx. Dean is an actuary at Taylor Fry, focusing on valuation, pricing and analytics for general insurers. He plays with maths puddles and music, reads weird philosophy, and can't wait for the buffet dinner tonight, which I'm assuming you mean last night. Between them, Scott and Dean have experience across a range of general insurance areas, including pricing, reserving, portfolio monitoring and capital management. Please join me in welcoming Scott and Dean.
Good morning and welcome. Our presentation has more of a practical focus, and it really seeks to answer the question, how well are insurers prepared to deal with the disruption and innovation that we've discussed so far? The way we've gone about this is to look at innovation in other industries and try and distill some common themes, and then we overlay the strategies of two of the largest insurers in Australia and try and answer the question, are insurers prepared? Firstly, just a few brief statistics. These statistics are taken from the APRA quarterly data, and there are a few striking conclusions that we found. The first of which is that there's been zero growth in profit over the last 12 years, and that's displayed by the green series in the chart to the left. The second observation is that the composition of gross written premium by class of business has been pretty static over the last 5 years. And finally, insurance related to motor vehicles relates to close to 40% of the total gross written premium. So anything that occurs in the motor vehicle industry is likely to have a significant impact on insurance. Insurers have operated using the same business model for quite some time, and this is referred to as the pipeline business model. And the underlying features of this model is that value is created upstream, the product or service is consumed downstream, and that there's a clear delineation between buyers and sellers. And the most important feature of this business model is that the product or service is viewed as having value in its own right. This business model has been around for quite some time, and the simplest example is manufacturing, but also the typical student-teacher model where the teacher delivers the information to the student is another more novel example. We've heard a lot throughout this seminar that this current approach is facing a number of challenges and pressure on multiple fronts, so I won't spend too much time on this slide. But greater connectivity, more information is available now than ever before, and availability of new products and services is ultimately leading to more choice for consumers. What this means for business is that there's increased competition, a greater focus on innovation, and new ways of doing business. The areas that we'd like to look at are the automotive industry, the entertainment industry and blockchain technology, which really cuts across a number of industries. And there was a really good presentation yesterday that went through the technical workings of blockchain technology. Here our focus is very much on the applications and the principles and what we can take away from the observations and apply to insurance. Over 91 million vehicles were manufactured in 2015, and there's been quite a sustained growth in the number of vehicles produced for quite some time. 3% per annum growth over the last 5 years, and China is now the dominant vehicle manufacturer. However, the industry is facing a number of changes, and we'll get to those on the next slide. The industry anticipates that there will be growth in the number of vehicles manufactured going forward, but this growth will be at a lower rate. And the concept of shared mobility is one of the main drivers of this assessment. There are a number of factors placing a great deal of scrutiny and challenge on vehicle manufacturers' current business model, and I've listed a few of these on this slide. The first of which is a change in consumer behaviour. So there's been a rise in car sharing and e-hailing services, but significantly this has been coupled with change on the licensing front. So a McKinsey article cited that in the US, the proportion of people who hold a driver's licence has reduced from 76% in 2000 to 71% in 2013. In addition, we've seen innovation in the way vehicles are powered. Electric vehicles are now becoming more affordable and more practical. And while this does not represent a disruptive technology, it really shows the need to innovate and to be up to date with current practice. Finally, autonomous vehicles have received a lot of publicity, and I won't spend a great deal of time on them at the moment, but the technology is reasonably well advanced, and there are plenty of issues for society and insurers to work through. A really interesting article that Dean and I found relates to Uber and their launch of a driverless car service. And there are a few caveats around this. It's driverless, but you're able to experience a ride in a driverless car. However, two trained technicians will accompany you. And this was launched in September 2016 in the US. Significantly, Uber's president or vice president of engineering has come out and said self-driving is core to Uber's vision. This really is very significant in the sense that it represents the impact a new market entrant can have on an established industry. But it also shows that Uber is challenging its currently successful business model, and it represents quite a substantial change for their current operating model. And all this culminates in the concept of individual car ownership being challenged, which has very large ramifications for insurers and society as a whole. We've tried to distill one key message from each of the case studies examined, and the key message that we took out of this was that it's essential to embrace technology, whether you partner with technology firms or develop the expertise in-house. You really have no choice but to adopt technology if you are to succeed going forward.
All right, so there are a couple more examples that we'll go through, and we're trying to get some main lessons from disruption in other industries. So one is the entertainment industry, and it has gone through many fundamental changes. So in the early 1900s, film was introduced, and people were going to the cinema for the first time, and that completely changed entertainment. Then in 1956, the television was introduced to Australia, and within 3 years, it became Australia's primary source of entertainment. More recently, there's been a big change in this form of entertainment, and that comes from on-demand streaming. And this is mainly as a result of increased broadband speeds and the ability to stream movies directly. And this resulted in customers having much greater flexibility and choice in what they were able to view. So one good example of disruption, so a particular company or business model disrupting an old business model, is the difference between Blockbuster and Netflix. So this shows the risk that current companies face if they're just going to stick with the old business model. So to compare them, Blockbuster, if you even remember going there, you had to walk into the store and walk around and choose which DVD or VHS you actually wanted to watch, and then you'd have to leave and return it on time or else they would fine you. In 2004, they were huge, and they had around 60,000 employees and 8,000 stores. But then within 6 years, they filed for bankruptcy. And the main reason was they were reliant on this physical distribution chain and on the penalty fees to make a profit. Now, if we compare this with Netflix, Netflix had a very agile business model. So originally, they actually offered monthly subscription by mail order, and I vaguely remember this, where apparently you could write into them and then select which DVDs they mail to you, and they would mail it to you. And this was already a big departure from Blockbuster's business model. In 2000, they approached Blockbuster and offered a partnership where they were going to run Blockbuster's online offering, and Blockbuster was going to promote them in-store, but this never eventuated. And then finally, they changed their business model even further to adapt to the technology, and they offered the streaming service that we now know today that has effectively taken over the live entertainment industry from TV. So the two main lessons here, one is similar to Scott's example of Uber, which is that one needs to embrace the technologies and adapt when new technologies come about and challenge the business model. And the other lesson is that customer behavior and preferences really need to be taken into account. So lately, customers demand much more flexibility in what they want. Netflix was able to provide that, but Blockbuster just didn't change their business model to adapt to it. So another example that I'm going to try to quickly cover, this is something that Dimitri talked about yesterday, which was a really good talk. And Dimitri, you can correct me in the question time, not live. And blockchain initially disrupted the banking sector to some extent through Bitcoin. So that's the example that most people are familiar with. And I'm going to try to explain roughly how blockchain works with a focus on disruption. So the essence of blockchain's disruption is that it removes the need for a centralized authority. So taking Bitcoin as an example. On the left is the old system with a bank. So suppose that Joe promised to pay Ali $10,000. What Joe needs to do is register the transaction through the bank, and then the bank plays the role of checking two main things. So one, the bank checks that Joe actually did make the promise, so that it wasn't forged or it wasn't a fraudulent promise. And then secondly, the bank makes sure that Ali gets the money only if Joe actually has the money. So a big part of this system is that we all have to trust the banks to operate quickly and reliably and not to be hacked with all of our sensitive information. And further, we have to fund the bank's operation, or we have to, shareholders have to, people fund it through fees. So there's a big cost incorporated in having this system in place. Now, we'll compare this to the blockchain. So these two little kind of segments in the chain, this represents what the blockchain essentially is, which is, it's just a list of all historical transactions chained together. So compared to the bank example, with the blockchain, if Joe wants to pay Ali $10,000, he just adds the promise to the blockchain at the end, and he stamps it with a signature. And this is a kind of cryptographic signature. So then instead of the bank checking the two things that I mentioned before, everyone can check that Joe's signature is valid, so everyone checks that it's not forged because there's a cryptographic way to check that it's genuine. And everyone can check that he actually has the money because they have access to all historical transactions. So you can just calculate if he currently has enough money to pay Ali. So this new model, it disrupts the banking model of being a centralized authority for transactions, and it removes the need to rely on the banks for the things that I mentioned before. So blockchain has been implemented in many other cases as well, and Dimitri covered a couple of these. So one is tracking ownership. And this is directly analogous to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is essentially tracking ownership of money. But blockchain is good at tracking ownership of anything. So one example we have is on the left here, a company called Digital Asset Holdings, and its purpose is to remove the need for a clearinghouse when you're buying shares. So if you try to buy shares off someone, it usually has to go through a clearinghouse to validate the share transfer. this company, Digital Asset Holdings, have created a platform that allows you to bypass that through the blockchain technology. And the ASX recently invested $15 million in it to try to further their development of this kind of technology. And some huge companies that are listed on the left there are also backing Digital Asset Holdings. So another company that I won't get into the details of right now is Everledger, and it's roughly the same idea, similar to Bitcoin. You're tracking ownership of something, and in this case, it's diamond ownership. And this example actually has some very interesting applications in relation to insurance, because it can help reduce fraud in particular ways. Because if you're tracking the ownership of a diamond and then someone claims that it's been stolen, you might eventually be able to prove, or immediately be able to prove, that actually it wasn't stolen and the ownership is out there on the blockchain for anyone to see. So one more example that Dimitri also covered. And now it just becomes clear that our talk should have been way earlier in the program, because a lot of this has been said already, unfortunately. But a different implementation is something called smart contracts. And the disruption here is that it disrupts lawyers' roles in drafting and assessing compliance with contracts. So that usually costs a lot of money. The way that it works, in essence, is that Bitcoin, Joe would add... So in the case of Bitcoin, Joe would add the payment to all of the historical transactions. But because the blockchain is digitally implemented, you can actually add a lot more information than just, I promise to pay Ali 10,000. So you can add in it conditions under which the promise gets executed. And you can also add heaps of details about the state of the world in the blockchain itself. So you can have the conditions relate to the state of the blockchain. Now, one example is on the left here. There was a shipment of cotton in October 2016, so around a month ago. And this was made, it was facilitated by Commonwealth Bank, and it was made between a company in Australia and a company in America, where a shipment went from America to China. Then as soon as the shipment arrived in China, there were some Internet of Things devices on board, which then automatically uploaded the arrival onto the blockchain. And then as soon as that was loaded, it forced the contract to be executed automatically on the blockchain. So this saved the companies quite a lot of money in and time in verifying that the contract was actually executed correctly. Another example is a platform called Ethereum, which is basically, it's similar to Bitcoin. It is its own finance, like its own currency, and it has built in a blockchain implementation of this smart contract idea. Now, a company called the DAO was launched, and it broke the record for crowdfunding ever. It made $150 million in crowdfunding. And what it was is it's a venture capital fund. So just to give you an idea of the kind of disruption, is what it allows is for people to invest money that they want to invest in upcoming entrepreneurs. Then entrepreneurs will put forward ideas. The people who have invested their money will then vote on all of the ideas. And then in the end, the votes are tallied up, and whichever one wins the votes is automatically paid through this venture capital fund. So unfortunately, the DAO got hacked for a very large part of the money that they had, and maybe we can discuss this in the question time. All right, so the lesson from blockchain is that if your only role is to play a kind of intermediary or central authority role in verifying transactions, then beware, because the blockchain might come along and make you redundant. All right, so now after these examples of disruption in other industries, we have to ask the question of whether or not insurers are ready and vulnerable to these same kinds of disruptions. So just to recap, the lessons were: number one, embrace the technology and opportunities created, and don't be afraid to partner with upcoming firms. Number two, understand your customer preferences and behavior in the face of these changing environments. And number three, add real value. So this is the lesson from blockchain. It's that you can't just act as someone who verifies transactions when technology is there to potentially take your place. And the overall lesson is don't be afraid to challenge the current business model. All right, so now the insurance perspective. There are a number of factors that insurers need to consider if they want to survive in this new world. Number one is the platform business model. So this as well has been discussed in the plenary yesterday and also in other sessions at the conference. Some examples of platform business models are on the right there. So this is like eBay and Uber and all of the standard examples that you've heard too much about. The basic idea is to facilitate exchanges between groups of people. And this isn't new. It's not a new idea at all, because for thousands of years there have been physical marketplaces and shopping malls, and there have been auction houses as well. So this idea of an exchange platform that allows people to come together and make transactions, it's been around for a long time. The difference is now, with increased connectivity, people can do this at a much greater scale. And the key from a disruption perspective is that the business model scales much better than the traditional physical business model. So the second point, insurers need to move up the value chain. So Scott discussed the traditional model, the pipeline model, and this particularly relates to insurers usually taking the role of being very responsive and reactive. So they get told about an event and then they pay out claims. But we think that this probably needs to change in the changing environment. So insurers should move up, become more involved in risk mitigation and prevention. And for example, cyber policies, they are now partnering up with IT firms so that when a policyholder makes a claim, the insurer will send through a group of people to try to mitigate the risk and reduce the amount of losses immediately. Another example is that when there are hailstorms, some insurers will send out texts to their policyholders saying there's going to be a hailstorm, be careful. And this is an example of a risk avoidance method. So another thing that we think that insurers need to do in this changing environment is focus on customer and culture. And again, this has been spoken about a lot at the conference. And it has to do with the culture of people changing. So people like viewing ratings and giving their own ratings and complaining or praising companies. And insurers need to be well on top of this. This also relates to focusing on customer service and customer experience. So people demand immediate responses to things and responses on various different platforms and through various media. So now I'll give back to Scott to quickly discuss the state of play for a couple of the big insurers and whether or not they're able to respond to these kinds of needs.
Throughout this session, we've heard from, or I should say, throughout this seminar, we've heard from Suncorp and IAG, and they've given us their take on their key priorities going forward. What this next section does is it places the strategy of Suncorp and IAG side by side and attempts to answer the question, are these insurers really prepared? So Suncorp have announced that their focus is very much on the digital marketplace, and they see that as a means to bringing customers together and meeting more of their needs. They want to interact with them through this digital platform far more often than they have in the past, and they want to integrate third-party components in that platform so it goes above and beyond what typical insurance products do. They've changed their focus to move away from looking at general insurance and life insurance and banking in silos and have reorientated themselves to focus on the customer journey. And they consider the customer journey across four key areas. And I thought the mobility title is quite telling in the direction of the industry, the motor insurance industry. The main focus on this is to increase customer lifetime value, not just focusing on renewal rates over the next period, but looking at the value of the customer to Suncorp over their lifetime and meeting their needs. Suncorp recently invested $5 million in Trov. So what is Trov? It's an on-demand insurance platform, and it collects customer information about the things that they own. And significantly,
customers are able to turn insurance on and off using this platform. And it really does represent a significant departure from insurers' business models where you underwrite a risk and there's quite a lengthy policy document that that you are expected to read and sign. So it's very much focused on the younger market at this stage. IAG have a very similar focus on the customer, and they list their growth levers as great customer experiences, corporate partnering, and customer-led digital ecosystem. They have a digital lab which focuses on innovation and identifying and harnessing disruptive technology. They've also created a startup funding unit. IAG has partnered with Braintree, which is a payments platform, and they're using this for their share cover product, which offers cover to homeowners who rent their houses or apartments out using the likes of Airbnb. So there's very much a focus on the customer across both these major insurers. In conclusion, insurers have certainly recognised the need for action. They have devised strategies that are aimed at harnessing this new technology and making the most of the data that they have available and attempting to enhance the customer experience. The challenge with anything really, I guess, is in the successful implementation and the level of customer engagement that they're able to drum up. But one thing's for sure, new market entrants are certainly going to bring fresh ideas and fresh perspectives on the way of doing business. So on that note, I'd like to open it up for questions and discussion. And I would like to extend an invitation to anyone in the audience to answer one of the questions raised. We'd like to have very much a discussion about these issues.
And if I can just remind people, because it's being recorded, if they can come up to the microphone and state their name when they're saying their question. I might kickstart it then. You talked with the three examples that you had across the automotive and entertainment industries and your blockchain technology about the key messages being embrace technology, know your customers, and make sure you're adding value. What do you see as some of the major barriers for insurers to be able to actually do those things?
I mean, I think insurance has been viewed historically very much as a grudge purchase. It's not an attractive proposition when you decide how to spend your money and who you want to engage with on a regular basis. So I think the real challenge is reorientating insurance and sort of coupling with the services and the technology which appeals to customers. I know we heard today about the focus on data and just the journey it takes to change old systems and be able to access information in a timely and effective way. And I think that's one of the major hurdles in making this a commercial reality and the speed at which this kind of technology is going to be launched.
Just one more quick thing. So Scott mentioned that it's kind of a grudge purchase, and I agree with that. Insurance isn't viewed as a very positive, exciting thing to go purchase. And to add to how insurers are kind of trying to deal with this is someone from IAG yesterday mentioned that they've launched this product called Mums & Co., which I thought was really interesting, and it directly relates to the idea of a platform, and it's that it kind of just facilitates discussion in general, so very non-insurance related discussion, but then they just sneak in insurance products. So they're trying to get rid of this whole idea of it being a grudge purchase and rather just incorporate it as part of people's lives that they consider to be more of a positive aspect.
Yeah, and I guess part of the discussion yesterday was to develop innovative thinking. There was touch points on having diverse teams, so you're having different people bringing different ideas, going out and asking your customers about what they want, so you're more informed. But it looks like we've got another question.
So my question sort of comes from thinking about, like, you guys talked a lot about the role of some of these technologies in disrupting intermediaries and the role of the intermediary. And in some ways, insurance is, I guess the role of insurance is to be an intermediary for capital, to the extent that individuals don't have the capital to sort of manage the risks that they're exposed to, they go to an insurance company to be that intermediary. So do you see that risk in that context? Do you see a risk for the role of the insurer being a capital intermediary being disrupted and taken away, if there's some potential to bring shareholders and people with capital directly together with people that are after insurance? Interested in your views on that.
So I think one response to that is this idea of kind of strong P2P insurance as opposed to what I would maybe call like weak P2P. So there's an example of P2P insurance, which is where groups of people, so it was spoken about earlier in the conference, where groups of people get together and kind of have joint contracts, or else there's some association with the charity. So this is a form of P2P insurance. But then a stronger form would be where people actually front up the capital themselves and skipping the middleman, which is exactly what you've just mentioned. So I think this is a risk. There are big regulatory barriers at the moment, but one of the things to learn from the case of Uber is that they just kept on pushing and then the regulation ended up changing. So there's definitely a risk of that kind of a thing happening, but obviously the technology would have to be developed a lot more than it is today, and maybe Dimitri knows more about this than me, about whether or not this is actually feasible at the moment. But yeah, I think it definitely is a big risk.
John Killick, thanks guys. That was actually really interesting as to the perceptions and actually using real-time examples. So we've heard a lot about it at the conference already. Do you think companies, if I went to Suncorp or IAG and said, look, I've got 5 policies with you, let's engage, are they ready for that sort of engagement? Or are they only looking to try and increase their market share with new people by trying, you know, things like the mums one and the other things? It's interesting, you know, I spend a lot of money on insurance and I'm trying to work out whether I'm getting any value.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting question and a very difficult one to answer. But I think one of the things that we took away from looking at the impact of technology on a whole heap of industries is that, you know, you are going to have to increase the level of service if you're going to remain competitive in an interconnected world where there are other mechanisms by which you can, you know, you can do business and achieve the same result. So I think, yeah, to the extent that there is a focus, I probably agree with you in the sense that there is a focus on new business and securing customers, but I don't think that's entirely to the detriment of those who are, you know, existing customers of an insurer.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it harks back to the old sales adage. It costs you X percentage time and effort more to get a new sale than it does to actually retain one, a customer. So, you know, it's quite interesting in looking at what they're saying they're going to, the potential customer engagement. But, you know, the guy earlier said, NAB does nothing for me. I like to be able to ring up and they know who I am once I've identified myself. Michael said that earlier. But, you know, it's interesting. Are they looking at to retain as much as get anything else?
Exactly. And from our sort of outside analysis, yeah, there certainly is a strategy in place to try and retain customers. But, you know, the different portions of the market, for example, those who are younger and, I guess, used to choice and technology, you know, it's a bit of a different proposition to having someone who has a mortgage and you know, buildings and contents insurance. It's very sort of a different choice that consumers make. And, you know, I mean, I agree. My own sort of experiences lead me to believe that at this stage, there's a lot that can be done.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. But good session. Thanks.
Yeah.
probably have time for one more question. I've got another, well, it's sort of partly a comment and partly a question. In this changing landscape, we heard yesterday insurers, and I guess actuaries as well, need to be adaptive to this, the changes that are happening and be innovative and refocus their traditional interactions with customers and service offerings. And we heard from Katie in the first plenary about the value of having diverse teams to be an enabler of innovation. And you've mentioned that IAG have built a collaborative corporate partnerships with, one example was Braintree. So my question, got to it eventually, is what other elements and considerations should insurers be concentrating on to make sure that they are adaptable and innovative?
Thanks, Dean. That's a really good question and a very difficult one to answer. But there's no doubt about it that, you know, people do like to rate experiences. And if you just consider the customer experience as a journey, it goes far beyond initial policy acquisition and sort of in the event of a claim, engaging with the insurer at that time. So, I mean, I think if it's possible to try and change the sort of the reputation or enhance the reputation of insurers and make it more of an attractive proposition. And the way that we've seen that done in a number of cases is partnering with different firms and bringing in different products and offerings into the platform. But it's a very sort of tricky thing to actually do.
One more comment is, so the question was, what should insurers focus on in regards to innovation? And I think some lessons to be learned from the other examples of disruption are that we probably don't know the answer to that, and there's a good reason why. It's because the ones who will be doing the disruptions and the new technologies that come about or the new ideas that come about are exactly those innovations that you're asking for. So I think there's a good chance that there'll be really strange new concepts that will disrupt particular aspects of the insurance product offering that we just don't really have much of an idea about at the moment.
I think we might be out of time. So if you could join me in thanking us, both Scott and Dean, and to please fill out your speaker feedback on the Institute's website. Thank you.